The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, CEO at ExchangeWire, and I'm the host for this week's podcast, she says in an excited voice, because I don't think I've hosted a podcast in
my 2 years. You're just so excited about that.
Exactly. And my fantastic guests, already probably been introduced by a little spoiler laugh there, from the ExchangeWire team, Lindsay Rowntree, COO. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello.
And Matt Broughton, Research Lead. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Rachel.
So it's been a very busy week in ExchangeWire Towers this week, and we've kicked off this morning session by eating celebrations. So we're a little bit...
Christmas is finally here.
Christmas is finally here.
We're celebrating. Not quite sure what for, but yeah.
Why not? Exactly. A little bit sugar high. Anyway, moving on to discussion of this week's news stories, we've got some pretty juicy news stories in the world of marketing and advertising to go through today. The first is the fantastic summary of closing arguments in the case between the US versus Google, specifically the DOJ versus Google over in the US, as each side summarized their closing arguments in preparation for the judge to go away and deliberate. So there was, as I mentioned, fantastic summary produced of both sides' closing arguments earlier on this week, which raised some really pertinent issues, and I wanted to get a perspective from both Lindsay and Matt on this. So just a quick rundown for listeners on the position on both sides of the fence. I know we've been talking about this case for months and months, so people have got a general perspective on it, but here's a whistle-stop tour. The DOJ's closing arguments presented in court this week over in the US really highlighted the key areas of their argument, which is that there is discrepancy.
Discrepancy.
There we go. Thank you, Research Lead.
I don't know what you were going for.
But I don't know either. I think I wanted to say disparity. Oh, disparity. Yeah. There we go, between the two. That's what happens when you have two bounties before the podcast. Discrepancy between the DOJ and Google's definition of the advertising, digital advertising market, and that really underpins part of the DOJ's claims, because they're arguing that open web display ads, ad servers and ad exchanges are each distinct markets, and Google doesn't agree with that. Obviously, the DOJ are putting forward strong arguments about the monopoly power of Google. They presented evidence of 80 to 90% market share for Google in DFP and Google Ads, and 56% of market share in AdX. They're going in strong on anti-competitive conduct, highlighting practices that Google were heavily involved in over a number of years around exclusivity arrangements and manipulative tactics to give Google the opportunity to gain and retain market dominance. And of course, they then underpin all of that with the impact that this has had on competition, with the DOJ arguing that Google's actions led to less innovation, reduced choice and higher prices in the ecosystem. In rebuttal, Google's closing arguments presented by their lawyers obviously disputed those points on market definition. They argue that it is...
Naturally.
Yeah, exactly. That it is a single market, single two-sided market. They also claim that Google faces significant competition from the likes of Meta, Microsoft and Amazon, challenging DOJ's monopoly allegations. They argue a lot around innovation and interoperability, saying that Google emphasizes how much investment they've made in making their products interoperable and interoperable.
It's all going well.
Swimmingly well.
I wonder if Rich Ashton slipped one of his codeines.
His codeine.
Well, you're not gently swaying at this point, so...
For listeners, if we keep this edited in, Rich Ashton from FPC is in the office this morning, and he's got a little bit of a back issue for which he's been given very strong painkillers, and we were laughing at him this morning because he's off his chops. Anyway, I can't talk. Right, so back to interoperability and innovation. So obviously the DOJ, the Google are emphasising that that has been the ethos of the way that they build products, which is a fair point. And they talk a lot about their spirit of equal access to technology. Of course, that's refuted by the DOJ's stance on anti-competitive behaviour in a general sense. And then market growth. Google presented data that showed a different version of market growth than what was presented by the DOJ. And it represents a decreasing figure in terms of Google fees to counter the monopoly claims. All in all, it appeared that the DOJ's arguments were very strong and very weighty, and Google's closing statements sort of struggled a little bit under the weight of those arguments. And the judge had said a decision is likely Q1 2025. There is so much to unpack in all of that. Loads of industry analysts and commentators and all those ad tech professionals that gave evidence in this trial, but I'm really interested to understand what you guys think these closing arguments are doing to the case. Where do you think Google's position is in this? And what do you think the chances are of the judge ruling in Google's favour, since it seems to be stacked the opposite, but you just never know how these things are going to unfold. Matt, I'm going to come to you first for some perspective on this.
Yeah, so Google's arguments to me, it seemed like what they've been doing throughout the trial, and it seems to be very kind of quibbling, very kind of technical. Oh, this isn't the, you know, right market to be looking at. They kept trying to almost confuse the judge into thinking, you know, open web advertising is the same as advertising on, like, you know, the likes of Meta, the likes of TikTok, which it just isn't. It was overly reliant on those arguments around market definition. And it essentially argued that a digital advertising transaction is a one-to-one transaction. Money, you know, goes to the publishers, but it goes through, it's a dynamic auction that goes through multiple different elements. And I think the judge saw through that. And, she said that, you know, in terms of Google, they were relying quite heavily on a case against American Express a few years ago, which went, you know, against the DOJ. But, you know, the judge actively said, no, it's not quite like that. She said it was attractive at first, but now less so. So it looks as though one of, you know, Google's cornerstone arguments is not necessarily in play anymore. Also, there was quite a wonderful smackdown when Google argued that the DOJ was selectively picking statements by Google employees, only to be reminded by the judge, hang on a minute, Google, you've been either failing to save or actively deleting all communications around this case. So you can't say that they're selectively picking statements, because you've deleted any statements that could refute that.
You've selectively put statements forward, one could argue.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's that was a delicious smackdown. But, yeah, in terms of the witness testimony, like you said, it seemed a hell of a lot stronger for the DOJ than it did for Google. A lot of Google's experts have been kind of not necessarily drawn into question, but their suggestions have followed that kind of muddied argument. And I think precedent is just so important in law. And the fact that we've very recently had the Google search case, which has gone against Google, I think that will have, you know, really strong importance in that case.
Yeah. So many things going on in that. And I think that connected to one of the points you raised there, Matt, it's really interesting that in the presentation of their closing arguments, the judge got quite involved in both sides in asking follow-up questions and clarification questions. And I think the general consensus was that the DOJ's lawyers fared a lot better under the scrutiny of the judge than Google's lawyers did, exactly as you've described, trying to rely on alleged precedents set in previous cases, which of course now been superseded by the way that the market operates being completely different from when that case was brought forward, and also trying to pull on, one could argue, fairly petty pieces of arguments that were pretty wafer thin and that eventually led the judge back to criticising Google naturally anyway. So that all feels really shaky, right? Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with both of you. There were some very thin arguments from Google's side in terms of like how I think that the judge will rule. It feels like it should be a no-brainer, but as you said, you just don't know which way this will turn. And if you look at, you know, there are some points that have been made by the judge towards the DOJ case that are interesting. Like, for example, why didn't you use any advertisers in any of your testimony? And their rebuttal was, well, advertisers don't use Google tools, so it's agencies because they are the ones that use Google tools. Well, that's not true for a start. There are loads of advertisers that don't use agencies and use Google tools directly. It wouldn't have been that challenging to have found an advertiser that could have done that. But you have to then question, they probably have found advertisers and chosen not to use them. Is that because the relationship between advertisers and Google isn't quite as well understood, despite the fact they use Google tools, whereas agencies are much more embedded, and agencies have had problems with Google for years in terms of them getting in the way and them trying to go directly above their heads to advertisers, that agencies could have got more skin in the game of arguing that they're a monopolist versus advertisers that kind of will go, well, because we're only running one account, it's easier for us to use this, so we will use this, and that's not really a problem for us, we'll just deal with it. And maybe they don't understand the nuances directly of what that means for the monopolistic state of what we're dealing with here versus maybe an agency does. The reasoning behind using advertisers, I think, is false. Because they do use Google products directly.
They absolutely do. And in a way, you would have thought that would have lent into the DOJ arguments.
Yeah,
because you could easily have gotten an advertiser on the stand that effectively testified to using Google products because they're almost impossible not to use because they're so easy and they're so prevalent and there's so many incentives in order to use them. So surely that would have added weight to their case.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I think that's absolutely accurate. So that was interesting. I think that all but one of Google's representatives either are on the Google payroll or have been a recipient of a Google grant at some point of the past few years. So that doesn't really lend well to Google looking particularly good in this, the fact that they haven't even been able to find external people that are on Google's side. And there are arguments about like definitions of market and definitions of monopolies, like them versus Meta and versus TikTok. Meta and TikTok don't pretty much own the supply chain. Yes, okay, they're very dominant in the advertising space, but this isn't just about the advertising. First of all, there's the I can't even speak myself now. Maybe I've been taking the codeine too. First of all, there's the
celebrations.
The stat cited that 9 out of 10 transactions, like it leads back to Google. Google is involved in 9 out of 10 transactions in some way. The same can't be said for TikTok or Meta. They're so inherently involved that, you know, that actually the ad tech industry has had to create hacks to try and stop Google getting involved, and that still hasn't kind of done the job they expected it to do. Well, it did, but then they had to get Google involved again. You know, I'm referring to header bidding, obviously. There's so much to this that I'd fail to see how the judge could not rule in the DOJ's favour, because every single, and it, you know, the DOJ kept saying, look at the letter of the law. When it comes to letter of the law, this is a case of monopoly, like pure and simple. What other outcome could you reach?
Yeah. I also think that it's definitely going to mark a period in history in terms of the definition and understanding of the digital advertising ecosystem, because and that's why I think it's really interesting that both sides have weighed in heavily on the definition of the ecosystem as a market, whether it's a single market or whether it's a series of markets. Because, you know, my personal view is in order to determine it as a single market would mean that you need to have a completely consolidated technology ecosystem underpinning that, and we don't. I'm not saying that we might not eventually get there, who knows, but actually I think it's just way too complex for us to ever get there. The point is that, you know, gone are the days of being able to argue it as a single market, which is what I think Google was trying to do, to rely on some, you know, effectively historical context. Because it's and that was before the industry was as mature as it is now. It's a much more mature industry with very distinct sub-markets within the overall marketplace, and that needs to be recognised. And I think the importance, the weight of passing law and legislation, or putting forward, finding in favour of various litigious claims or not, is not going to have skipped the judge's attention. And I think she's therefore going to want to make sure that this is an appropriate point in history when it comes to understanding the digital advertising ecosystem.
I totally agree with that. And I think that Google maybe didn't expect the DOJ or the judge to be quite as up on what the terminology is. Like, because there's obviously been, you know, hearings in the past where you've had senators ask the dumbest questions to the likes of Google, and they've just been like, oh my God, like, you don't even understand what paid search is. So like, this is the most pointless conversation ever. I'm not saying Google thinking they're walking into that kind of scenario, but I think they're walking into a scenario where they thought, like, you know, we know this, we built this, we have the upper hand here. I think it's been fairly quickly proven that they don't. And that's why I feel like they crumbled a bit when it came to the judge's questioning and the judge's rebuttals during the closing statements, because they weren't expecting this level of pushback and this level of understanding from the DOJ and the representing judge as well. And I think that, you know, there's even things like them saying that everything we're doing is for the consumer. All the security we're putting in place, that's all for the consumer. And it's like, well, no, it's not. It's you and everybody else, because Apple and, you know, everyone can be blamed for this as well. You are using it as a way of trying to completely insulate the walled garden and claiming everything has to be done, you know, but under Google's watch, under Google's umbrella, to keep it within Google. It's not for the consumer at all.
Exactly, to assert your market control, exactly. Basically. And if that's not anti-competition, then I don't know what
100%.
Is. 100%. Yeah. Which actually leads us very nicely. There's so much more to talk about in that case, but, you know, it's a podcast. Let's try and keep it short. Leads us very nicely into the second news story, which is publishers coming out in criticism of Google's AI overviews tool since it's having an impact on their traffic numbers. So Google's AI overviews is a product that's been available in the UK for about 3 months or so. I'm sure everyone will be familiar with it. These days you type anything into Google search bar and it will give you some AI generated answers before it gives you search results. Actually, as a user, find it really helpful because very often I'm typing things into a Google search bar just looking for a definition or a broad understanding of something rather than searching for actual products or websites or news references and links. So I can see how it is, I'm gonna use this word for the second time this week, beguiling to
excellent.
Beguiling makes a return.
Beguiling to the consumer. I can't remember the context I used it in yesterday, but I did get a compliment. Someone said, oh, very good use of the term beguiling.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Anyway, so the Google, the impact of AI overviews, according to publishers, is that they've typically seen a 5 to 10% decrease in search traffic since the product's been launched in the UK. Some specialist publishers are experiencing up to 50% traffic drops in niche content areas. News UK, for example, reported a 40% year-on-year decline in The Sun's global monthly unique users. But, I mean, that could be a result of, quite frankly, many things. Anyway, understandably, publishers are trying to put forward the argument that they're doing their best to adapt to this changing landscape. They're accepting that, obviously, AI is being embedded in a number of different tools that we use online to seek and search for information, but that they're concerned about the impact this is going to have on their long-term business models and the sustainability of quality journalism. Google refutes those claims by saying that AI overviews increases clicks to publisher sites and that their products represent a shift in their search engine from being a list of information, like a Yellow Pages directly, to a more informative answer engine, which effectively is like any kind of AI tool that we're all familiar with using these days. So really interested to understand what you think of the publisher's perspective in this and whether the DOJ case that we've just been talking about could have an impact on this scenario. The first thing that springs to mind for me is Google's refuting the claim that AI overviews is reducing publisher traffic. Actually, it's adding to the possibility of their content being discovered, which just reminds me of the argument they've always put in place around search. Is that a load of bullshit or is that a load of bullshit? Matt, I'm going to come to you again first on this.
It's an absolute crock of shit. Like... You can't say, you know, Google can't say, oh no, where it's actually increasing clicks when you've got cases of publishers saying, no, we've lost 50% of our referral traffic directly as a result of these AI overviews. And I think those niche publishers with, you know, the evergreen content, they should be extremely, extremely worried. And, you know, there's not currently a way really of a, you know, blocking those AI scrapers without also blocking the scrapers for Google search. And obviously, you know, over time, because of monopolistic practices, as we found out in the previous, you know, Google search case, they, you know, they're reliant on that traffic. It's what's there. You know, who's got the biggest search market? It's Google. So if you lose that traffic, and if you block AI scrapers, you therefore block the Google search scrapers, then you'd have traffic drops of 80%, 90%, which obviously isn't sustainable for these smaller niche publishers with these more evergreen content. And, you know, you've got obviously Google running around saying, you know, oh, we've done some ever so lovely deals, we've got some ever so lovely press releases, oh, the relationship we have with publishers is, oh, it's so ever so lovely. And it's actually like, you know, yes, it's great for those that have actually struck deals around AI, but for smaller publishers, the ones that, you know, have been really affected and almost decimated in the last 20 years from various developments within, you know, internet advertising and internet publishing, they're not doing those deals with those publishers, and obviously also not dealing deals, if I can speak properly, I haven't even had a bounty, if dealing deals with those that are actively now suing Google, you know, because they see it as copyright theft, which I completely agree with. And I think, you know, for those that have actually struck the deals, you need to be extremely, extremely cautious, because not long ago, you know, we had the likes of Meta and video content that was hailed as the savior and the next thing for internet publishing. And that's obviously been backtracked on. And now you have the likes of BuzzFeed, which are so much smaller in terms of their market cap compared to where they were, because of, you know, these big tech companies backtracking on what they said would be the future of your business.
I mean, it's really interesting, again, another point in history, perhaps a turning point in history, where are we also then maybe seeing the death of the search engine as we know it? It is, we've been talking in the office here at Exchange Wire over the last 12 months about how AI, LLMs are replacing and chat models are replacing search generally in our day-to-day lives. So is this part of Google obviously trying to keep pace and trying to compete with the likes of ChatGPT and any other similar AI products that people might be flocking to over search? Lindsay, what do you think?
I would say yes, definitely. And I will speak from my own personal experiences that I have not really had that much experience with the Google AI overviews, because when I'm searching for something that will pick those things up, I'm normally using ChatGPT or I'm using Bing Copilot. So I will use Google to search for a product or search something I know that Google can help me with. But outside of that, if it's a question or a recipe or something, I will now go to other places. And I did actually, I was looking for something on Google. It was related to, it was like, is it safe to do this or that? Like, not, I'm trying to kind of, you know, go bungee jumping or anything, but it was, and it came up with
the advice, no. Lindsay, especially in your condition,
about
to have baby.
That's very true. That's very true. I'll avoid that for a few months.
Wait until the baby's arrived, then you can bungee jumping.
Okay, fine. Then the first thing I do, bungee jumping.
Exactly.
Absolutely. But I did, it was, is it safe to eat something in this context? And I looked on Google for it, and the AI overview said one thing, and the first result directly below it said the complete opposite. Yeah. And I was like, well, this is bloody helpful, isn't it? Like, I don't know what to do with this. It did, though, highlight that if I'd gone to ChatGPT, it would have told me one thing, and I'd have gone, oh, okay, I'll take that as gospel. Not as gospel. I'll take that as, that's good advice. But actually, Google kind of directly contradicted itself unwittingly and unknowingly. But I think that they definitely need to lean into AI, because there's so much traffic will be being lost by the likes of ChatGPT and the so many other AI tools and GPT tools that are out there at the moment anyway. The challenge that publishers have with Google, tying back into the monopoly practices we've all talked about, I'm going to say that word again because that just was the monopolistic practices that we've all talked about.
Excellent, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Is that from an organic perspective, from an SEO perspective, it's very difficult to track where traffic has come from and what could have caused a change in it. And because Google doesn't roll out things worldwide in one go, you might get this, one user might get this, the same user sitting next to you might get something completely different. It's very, very difficult. And Google will just come back to you and say, well, it could be that. That's probably one element, but also it could be a macro impact. It could be because of this. It could be because fewer people are searching it. And you don't know, you can't work that out, because Google have full control over all that information. So Google know damn well what's happening to traffic. They're telling us that it's actually improving for certain people. If you happen to be lucky enough to have your content scraped through by the AI tool and used in an AI overview, yes, you might get more links, but you probably won't, because your question's already been answered.
And therefore you don't bother going beyond that.
Yeah.
You know, in exactly the same way that we
use... Are you clicking on those?
I'm not, no. And it depends on what it is that I'm looking for. If it's something that requires, you know, verification of the results or more information, then I will. But if you are, if it's just a random sort of question, I'm just looking at what results it produces, and then I'm moving on to do something else. And so in that instance, I definitely think publishers are losing out for sure.
Exactly.
But go on.
I was going to say, what I found very interesting was the news about Reach actually getting great results from Google Discover. I hadn't heard of Google Discover. It took me quite a while to try and find it somewhere. But basically, if you go onto Chrome, it's not on the Google app for some reason. I've got an iPhone, not an Android. If you go onto Chrome and you go onto Google on Chrome, you've got a Discover tab and then a Following tab. Mm. So you can follow different news sources, or you can discover. And it will just kind of, you know, for someone like Reach, it's perfect, because Reach is obviously mostly very kind of news orientated, and certainly local news orientated, with all the different kind of local like websites for different towns and kind of everything happening in the local area. So it just, it's a bunch of utter rubbish. Like, I forgot what it was. A certain type of swan is swooping in Lincolnshire was one article that I read. Another article about some kind of like sunspot about 20 different things. I was like, wow, I'm not going to click on any of these. But Reach are actually getting, like, they reckon, record traffic by leaning into this instead. I keep saying leaning in. What am I, Sheryl Sandberg? Like, I hate that phrase so much.
I think I might have said leaning on earlier on. That's probably what's led us down this terrible leaning path.
I do not like that phrase at all. So I need to stop saying it. Anyway, they're focusing on that, and it's done really well for them from a traffic perspective. So they're not so fussed about the AI thing because they're going, we're doing really well off that. But as Matt, you pointed out, the evergreen aspect is what is concerning for the long tail publishers that have relied on Google for so long. They are really going to, you know, I think the reference was like how to boil an egg, or you know, questions like that, or like recipes for pasta and that kind of thing. They're the ones that are going to struggle, because you'll get a Google AI overview about how to do it, and you won't then, and then the long tail publishers will not get that traffic, yeah, and will lose out on revenue massively. If you're a news-based publisher, sure, you can focus and maximize Google Discover, but if you're not, you're really going to struggle.
Suffer.
And Google will go, well, we gave you all this in the first place, so it's, you know, we can just as easily take it away. Like,
which brings us
back to us, you wouldn't have got where you are anyway, so what's the problem?
Which brings us back to that kind of, you know, ongoing conundrum in the industry, which is how do publishers get appropriately compensated in a digital context for the news information, evergreen content that they pay, you know, trained journalists to provide and content writers and staff writers to provide. And that, I think, is the fundamental sort of issue underpinning our consumption of online information and content. It's been around, I think, since the internet was invented. And the whole idea was that it would be this great democratizing access to content. Great. How is it funded? It's been funded by advertising largely. How do we then make that ecosystem fair and equal? And then, of course, once you search, then, of course, we get into the machinations of the distribution of that content. How do people discover it? How do people find it? So, and Google have long since argued that they have been a powerful and almost irreplaceable discovery tool for a lot of publishers, which I don't think you can deny, in the same way that social media platforms have been too, and especially the traditional incumbents, the Metas and the Googles, who were the original architects of the way that we discover content these days. Now it's become, there's a proliferation of places that people might find that content. But those are the arguments they used over in Australia when the anti-competition in media law came out, that said that in order for search engines and social media platforms to reference publisher content, they had to pay publishers for it. Similarly to, you know, this AI overviews product, publishers then sought to do deals directly with Google for that. The arguments that they made, that Google made, were exactly the same. And I don't think we've actually progressed beyond that sort of quite circular debate, because I don't know what we do about it, right? Publishers obviously need to continue to diversify. It's really interesting to hear that some publishers are getting success via Google Discover. I don't use it, but I can see how if people have got it either sitting somewhere on their desktop or in their browser and on their phone, it would be really powerful, because basically it's going to be a feed of a lot of nonsense content.
Clickbaity stuff.
Swan
swooping.
Exactly. Well, there you go.
Essential news and information. So I can see how that would be really powerful. But then again, you know, then we start to get into the argument, or not the argument, but the sort of, pontificating about why we need to provide that traffic in the first instance, and is that actually, you know, is that content important, and is it just made for monetization? Is it, you know, so we start to get into all sorts of tricky territories. But I think for Google AI as it is, AI overviews as it is, I find it really useful because I'm still using Chrome a lot. I do also prefer to use AI products, and I use ChatGPT and Perplexity, which have a business model of returning funding to the publishers, which are the source of the information and content that they provide on the site. I still also am concerned about how up to date all of that information is, because there's still loads of things that you type into an AI.
Oh, yeah. It's not.
That's not up to date. So I still think we've got a ways to go. Mm. And I do concur with you, Matt, that, you know, Google's positioning in this, really, I think we'd all be better off if they were just honest about it and said, we needed to build an AI LLM because there's loads of other people doing it and we feel it goes really well with search. Sorry. Yes. Anyway, moving on to the third news story of the week. Changing digital media advertising marketing channels over to TV. ITV's share price soared 9% this week after reports that several investors are considering takeover bids for the broadcaster. Those investors include private equity investors, CVC Capital Partners was named, and also various broadcasters, a couple of French broadcasters, well, a big French broadcaster group, TF1, and also a French media conglomerate as well. And then also there was a British broadcaster that mostly deals with production, but of course has got deep pockets and interested in a potential takeover bid for ITV. So takeover rumours have been swirling around ITV for the past decade or so, but investors and industry analysts are now seeing ITV as a bit more vulnerable due to the decline in its share price. So it's currently valued at $2.5 billion, but that's significantly lower than its peak of over £2.60 per share back in 2015. So analysts are suggesting that the various segments of ITV's business, particularly ITV Studios, is probably worth a lot more than its current market valuation, and that's what's putting it in a position to look attractive to potential acquirers. I think this is a really interesting news story. It raises lots of interesting points about ITV as a business and independent broadcaster, what its future might look like, what impact that might have on TV and TV here in the UK. But I think it also is saying something about a traditional broadcaster that's got a really promising and growing digital business and streaming business that's doing very well, including the production side through ITV Studios, what that looks like as a business model for other potential broadcasters going forward. So how positive or negative do you think a takeover like this would be for ITV? And what do you think it would mean for the wider TV ecosystem, Matt?
So I think it really just depends on the model of that takeover. If it was for the whole of the business, then it could provide, you know, some much needed capital to further scale ITVX and the Planet V advertising products. So that, I think, could be hugely positive. But, you know, equally, you had ITV CEO Carolyn McCall quoted just last year saying ITV Studios is not for sale, and about how the stock market doesn't fully understand the relationship between that production arm and, you know, the core ITV business. And I don't think that rationale has changed in the last few years. Yes, ITV's revenues have looked a bit soft in the last year, but in its most recent financial results, you're comparing it to the Rugby World Cup last year, so it's always going to look a little bit more slow and sluggish. And I think ITV is a lot better placed than many, many, many European broadcasters in terms of how it's really leaned into those advertising products.
Leaned in again.
Yeah, there we go. Bloody hell. I didn't even think of it. Oh, no. And I think if ITV will split up, then it loses a production studio that's had a red hot run of form in producing content. And ITV Studios, it loses that direct relationship with one of the most trusted and long-standing broadcasters in the UK. And, you know, would the likes of Mr. Bates versus the Post Office have been as big a hit as it was if it was on a different channel? Perhaps not. So to me, it just seems a bit of a lose-lose situation to split it up. But obviously, you know, you've got many, many investors swirling around, and I think it's telling just how many potential acquirers were cited by this article.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it shows that they're looking to the health of the business. And to me, it's just like, if you've got that many people interested in buying you, surely that's a healthy business and you don't actually need to split it up.
Well, I thought it was quite interesting, the range of speculators as well. So, you know, actual private equity firms alongside, you know, TF1, which is a very similar style of broadcaster in France to ITV or Channel 4 here. In fact, they often do a lot of collaborations in terms of producing content. And then, you know, French media conglomerate and British production studios as well. So it was a really interesting array of potential acquirers. What do you make of this, Lindsay?
I'm very intrigued by it because it feels like if it were to happen, it would be a takeover of, it would be a divestment. It would be a breakup of ITV and a takeover, as you just said, Matt, a takeover of ITV Studios, which it feels like the kind of linear and streaming business of ITV is bringing down the overall share price, because they reckon, that, you know, spectators reckon that the markup of ITV Studios in isolation is worth more than the whole of ITV as it currently stands, which is an interesting thing to note, because it shows the value of production companies, it shows the value of ITV Studios. I don't think I've always known this, because I've known some people that worked in the production side of ITV, how many different things they produce. Like, there are so many things we watch on any channel, even Gilly Cooper's rivals,
exactly,
on Disney.
It's not just ITV content.
It's produced by ITV.
Yeah.
And often ITV will give stuff away that they think won't perform well on ITV. They'll go, BBC, do you want this? And BBC will go, yes, please, we'll take that. And that's been the case for so many popular shows. But it does stand to reason that actually the ITV Studios arm of the business is going to be very, very desirable and could be seen as very, very lucrative. I think Redbird Capital is one of the potential acquirers, and they bought All Three Media, who make Gogglebox, which, if you don't know what Gogglebox is, if you're not in the UK, it's basically people watching TV and you watch them watch TV and then you watch their reactions to that TV show. And
sounds
some people,
ridiculous, but it's unbelievably
it's
entertaining.
Unbelievable. And
it's
some people don't actually watch the TV show. They just watch it through Gogglebox and they have an opinion on that TV show through Gogglebox. It's just ridiculous. But yeah, so I think when Redbird Capital bought All Three Media, they realised just how lucrative having a studio is, and that's why All Three Media are now interested in the ITV Studios arm, because it's again, there's just so much stuff that can come out of it. But I then worry, if that were to happen, what would then remain for ITV as a broadcaster, and what that would look like, because they might not get they might be able to streamline, and they've already, I think, been doing some streamlining in terms of departments and kind of structure and everything else. And I think they need to be much more of that. Maybe there's too much focus going into the studio's arm that means that they're not able to put the focus into ITVX and the kind of the advertising products that you talked about, Matt, as well, and the linear kind of broadcast products. Maybe that will allow them to refocus on that and make sure that is the priority. But it could also do the opposite and actually take away valuable revenue and valuable resource for them to be able to pump into that and actually make it, actually improve it. So that's my concern, is what would the remaining kind of tiny ITV broadcaster actually look like, when at the moment it is quite a powerhouse thanks to the studio arm.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's also something that's been happening over the course of a number of decades, right? So way back when BBC sold, they didn't steal anything.
What did they steal?
They sold...
Accusations flying here.
They sold White City, which was, their TV studios, and that meant that they couldn't actually produce anything in BBC-owned studios anymore, certainly not in London. They then built studios up in Manchester. But for a lot of other stuff that was being produced that they wanted to produce or film or whatever in London, they used the ITV studios. And that's been happening for decades. Like you said, yeah. Lindsay, if you know anyone in London that's worked in TV and either, you know, on the sort of production side or the broadcast side, there's a lot of stories around that transition. It wasn't an overnight thing. And, unless it's that ITV studios just... Unless it's that ITV just foresee that they could make such an incredible amount of money from selling studios and get themselves out of what is no doubt a lucrative business, but also a very complex and probably expensive business as well. You know, back in the early days of Netflix, their business model, debates about whether they would go ad-funded or not. Before they did, one of the arguments I always used to use to back up the idea that they would need to eventually is that they were investing so much money in the production of all of these high-quality TV shows, and they are super expensive. Like, you either own your own studios, and if you don't, you're hiring someone else's. It's super expensive, loads of staff, blah, 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 blah. Well, ITV have been in that game forever, and while others were getting out of it, like the BBC, I mean, it's a different type of broadcaster, a public broadcaster that needed to balance their books and could see that they would make a lot of money out of selling White City, which they did. Cha-ching, thank you very much, Westfield, and half of agency land that's now based out there. So it was a different, you know, they had a different incentive, but maybe ITV are thinking about the amount of money that they could make off it. But then that begs the question that the two of you have raised: what do they do with all that cash and the remaining entity? I think it would be a real shame to not keep all of those entities together to further invest in and improve their streaming offering through ITVX and everything that they can produce in studios, and become a really serious competitor to some of the big major streamers that are not necessarily incumbent broadcasters, because I think they're ahead of the game from others.
And they could lose out, like if they divest studios that makes things like Love Island, one of the biggest smashes that's kind of internationally sold, because they're no longer connected and they could lose out on it. Like the new whatever ITV Studios looks like, whoever owns it could actually go, actually we're going to give it to Channel 4 instead, or we're going to give it to Netflix instead. And that's ITV gone. And there's a few shows like that, that ITV, you know, that are really kind of very lucrative for them as a broadcaster that they could lose out on.
Yeah, they've got cornerstone content essentially. And it's like you say, if they lose that, what is ITV left with in a post-divestment model, especially if, you know, they're no longer able to get content from ITV Studios, if they're backed by, say, the likes of TF1 and they're, you know, from the report, going after the channel side of it rather than the production arm of it, which seems odd to me because they've got experience with producing content in countries outside of France, but not in terms of broadcasting outside of France, which just seems a bit odd. And then obviously if they've got, they lose those business relationships, and like say if they lose Love Island, which I'll obviously be devastated by, not
of course,
at all.
Of course you
and
will.
I'm a celebrity and all, you know, those cornerstone
all your
things,
favourite shows,
all the things I watch just binging, then obviously it can be in real trouble. Yes, it can, you know, these things are cyclical and they may be able to get other things in, but equally These are programmes, these are shows that ITV has been running on for decades now. And if they lose that, then what is their standing in the land of Netflixes and Disney Pluses and Amazon Primes?
Just when their advertising experience on ITVX was improving as well.
Exactly.
Starting to actually get somewhere. That's yeah,
it.
You're right.
That's it. Anyway, it's all rumour and conjecture at this stage, which is what we love on the Mad Tech Podcast. That brings it to an end for this week. Thank you very much, Matt, for your insights and contributions.
No problem at all. I'll lean into further conversations going forward.
And Lindsay, thanks very much for telling us about your dislike of leaning in.
Yeah, I'm never going to lean in again. Never again.
Fabulous. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.